the leader of Lebanon's Hezbollah movement says Biden's regional visit is aimed at getting Arab states to increase their oil production amid the U.S.'s indirect war with Russia. Iran's president says American officials' frequent regional visits are meant to strengthen Israel's standing but will fail to bring security for the occupying regime. Also ahead, survivors of U.S. mass shootings and relatives of the victims ask lawmakers to ban sale of the powerful assault weapons used in those massacres. Welcome to World News. We're live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you very much for joining us. Our top story, the leader of Lebanon's Hezbollah movement says U.S. President Joe Biden's West Asia visit is aimed at convincing Arab states to boost their oil production as part of Washington's anti-Russia measures. Sayed Hassan Nasrallah said the U.S. administration wants regional Arab states to supply energy to Europe so the West would be able to cut off energy imports from Russia. He said the U.S. means to reduce Russia's oil and gas revenues amid Washington's indirect war against Moscow in Ukraine. Nasrallah also touched upon Hezbollah's recent dispatch of three unarmed drones to a Mediterranean gas field, which is disputed with Israel. He said the operation was aimed at showing that the Karish field is not safe for gas extraction operations.
We want the Israelis to take it down because we want their fighter jets to go up and go and shell rockets. We want them to hit their rockets. We want their rockets to come. We want fire to begin in their region in order for that ship and the engineers on that ship, on all those people on that ship, to know that they are working in a place which is not safe, that there is a true threat in that area.
Nasrallah said the drone operation was just a humble start, adding that a new formula is coming. He said if Lebanon is barred from maritime gas extraction, no one will be allowed to extract gas and oil, and no one will be able to sell gas or oil. The Hezbollah leader emphasized that the movement is able to hamper Israeli efforts to extract oil and gas from the Karish field. Nasrallah warned that Hezbollah is ready to take necessary military measures to protect Lebanon's rights. Nasrallah said Lebanon has a golden opportunity in the next 2 months to secure its maritime rights before the Israeli regime completes work at Karish. He urged Lebanese officials to use the movement as leverage in their maritime demarcation talk, saying Hezbollah is Lebanon's only strong point. Earlier, we were joined by our Beirut correspondent, Mariam Saleh, who gave us a roundup on the Hezbollah Secretary General's remarks about the Karish oil field dispute with Israel.
Said Nasrallah has basically uncovered the plans of the United States. He's uncovered what is happening behind the closed doors, what is happening behind all these talks and the so back and forth envoys of the U.S. coming to Lebanon for the issue of the so-called demarcation. That the main issue is the fact that the Americans need to provide petrol and gas to the Europeans. And they're striving for the fact that the Israelis provide that gas, provide that petrol, and leave Lebanon in that state of chaos, a state of economic collapse, let it undergo a state where they could not even provide 1 hour of electricity, which the Americans had promised. They had promised 1 year ago that they would give Lebanon an exception from the CSAR Act in order to be given gas from Egypt through Jordan, also through Syria, to have several hours of electricity. That has not been realized because he said that the main project is to put Lebanon in chaos, in addition to prohibiting Lebanon from drilling and extracting its own natural resources. So what we have here is the leader of the resistance basically saying that the resistance is ready to even start a war, not just be ready to deter the Israelis from any sort of invasion, or even to be ready to stop Israeli threats. They are actually ready to even start a war in order for Lebanon to extract its rights.
Now, the U.S. president arrives in Israel for the opening leg of his first visit to West Asia since taking office in 2021. Despite widespread criticism over his trip, Joe Biden has vowed to boost Washington's military support for Tel Aviv.
And with this visit, we're strengthening our connections even further. We have reaffirmed the unshakable commitment of the United States to Israel's security, including partnering with Israel on the most cutting-edge defense systems in the world. From here, I'm going straight to a briefing on Israeli missiles and rocket defense capabilities, including the U.S. support for the Iron Dome and Israel's new laser-enabled system called the Iron Beam.
Biden was speaking upon arrival in Tel Aviv earlier. Palestinian resistance groups denounced Biden's visit for serving the interests of the Israeli regime. After wrapping up his visit to the occupied territories, Biden will take an unprecedented direct flight from Israel to Saudi Arabia on Friday. He will hold talks with the kingdom's officials and attend the summit of political and economic bloc of six Arab countries called the GCC. U.S. lawmakers, including some Democrats, have already criticized Biden's trip to Saudi Arabia. They have cited the president's promise to put human rights at the heart of his foreign policy. Rights advocates also say Biden's trip could embolden Saudi Arabia to crack down on dissent abroad and restrict civil liberties domestically. Well, reactions are pouring in over the U.S. president's trip to Israel. A rights group has denounced the visit by putting up banners and billboards in the occupied West Bank city of Bethlehem to remind Joe Biden that Israel is an apartheid regime. The Israeli rights group Beit Salem says the U.S. government should be held accountable for the Israeli regime's violations and crimes against Palestinians in the occupied territories. It has also called on international bodies to push for an end to the Israeli apartheid system. Biden's visit and his meetings with Israeli officials are taking place at a time when the regime has intensified its deadly crackdown against Palestinians. Meanwhile, the May killing of veteran Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh has clouded Biden's trip. Washington has said there was no evidence the killing was intentional. That's while a United Nations Rights Office inquiry has concluded that Abu Akleh was in fact murdered by Israeli forces with, quote, several single seemingly well-aimed bullets. Iran's President Ibrahim Raisi says his country won't retreat from its rightful and reasonable stance in the talks aimed at reviving the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA. In a cabinet meeting, Raisi urged the U.S. to give up its so-called maximum pressure campaign, which has proved futile. He said Washington could have realized that the Iranian nation doesn't accept the language of force. Referring to a U.S. call for Iran to return to the JCPOA, Raisi underlined that it was Washington, not Tehran, that violated the deal.
The Americans have said that Iran should return to the JCPOA. While the Islamic Republic of Iran has never withdrawn from the deal, and it was America who violated the JCPOA. Today, it is a question not only for the Europeans, who are allies of the Americans in the negotiations, but also for all the nations around the world, why the United States did not adhere to its commitments in the JCPOA and withdraw from it.
Raisi further said the demands made by Iran's negotiating team are logical within the JCPOA framework. He also commented on U.S. President Joe Biden's trip to West Asia. The president said the repeated visits by American officials are aimed at consolidating Israel's position and pushing some countries to normalize ties with it. Raisi noted, however, that their efforts will in no way bring security for the regime. Raisi further said that Iran is closely monitoring regional developments and will decisively respond to any move against its territorial integrity. Turning elsewhere, survivors of recent U.S. mass shootings and relatives of people killed in them have asked lawmakers to ban the sale of powerful assault weapons used in those massacres. The appeal comes after the release of a video of the mass shooting at an elementary school in Uvalde, Texas, on May 24. The video shows a long delay by Texas police and federal agents before they acted to stop the mass shooting. The video has infuriated the parents of kids who were killed in the massacre, which claimed the lives of 19 children and two teachers. In 1994, Congress passed a 10-year ban on assault rifles and certain high-capacity magazines, but lawmakers let it expire in 2004 without renewing the ban, and sales of those weapons have soared since then. Following the Uvalde shooting, President Joe Biden appealed to lawmakers to ban assault rifles or raise the minimum age for buying them from 18 to 21. But Republican lawmakers, who see such a restriction as being against the constitutional right to bear arms, refused to go along with his proposal. Moscow says the United States and its allies are getting dangerously closer to a military conflict with Russia in Ukraine. Foreign Ministry spokesman Maria Zakharova has accused Washington of provoking an escalation of the crisis by launching a hybrid confrontation with Russia. She's warning that such actions could lead to a direct armed conflict between the nuclear powers. Since the beginning of Russia's military operation in February, the U.S. and its Western allies have been offering military support to Ukraine. Moscow has repeatedly warned Washington over such military assistance, including the delivery of heavy weaponry, saying that will add fuel to the fire of war. The European Commission admits its current strategy to compensate for reduced energy supplies from Russia is inadequate. Surging oil and gas prices in the EU resulting from sanctions imposed on Moscow are contributing to economic turmoil across the 27-country bloc. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
Europe is currently experiencing a heat wave. It means that overall energy consumption is lower than usual. However, winter is fast approaching. The EU has cut energy imports from Russia in retaliation for the war in Ukraine. The bloc has agreed deals with the US, Norway and Qatar to import liquefied natural gas.
Is this enough? No, I don't think it is enough. And this is the reason why on July the 20th we will come with further proposals.
If these proposals fall short, the EU faces a major energy crisis this winter. Economists are already painting a very gloomy picture.
We believe that we are going to face a recession during the winter, given all the headwinds we are facing right now, the energy situation, but also the cost of living situation that is having a strong impact on consumption.
Eurozone finance ministers claim all the blame rests with Moscow.
We started our meeting with a discussion on the economic situation, which continues to be challenging due to the impact of Russia's military aggression and all the global developments that arise from that.
Analysts say EU leaders are hurting their own citizens by placing enormous sanctions on Moscow. At the same time, Russia's economy seems to be performing well. Aside from soaring energy and food prices in the EU, there is worrying volatility in financial markets. The European Central Bank is raising interest rates. The euro is currently very weak, which has the effect of pushing up inflation even more. Croatia is due to become the 20th member of the Eurozone in January. The EU describes this as an historic step. The question is, will Croatians have much to celebrate by the time they start using the struggling euro? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Turning to France, where the ride-hailing company Uber has always been viewed with scepticism, but a leak of company documents now shows their influence has already reached the very top. President Emmanuel Macron is facing calls for a parliamentary inquiry regarding alleged secret deals he made to break Uber into the French market. Rami Mazahari has more from Paris.
French President Emmanuel Macron has become the highest profile name tarnished by the so-called Uber files, a massive leak of company documents. The whistleblowing appears to detail the ride-hailing company's law-breaking and collusion with political elites across the West. While economy minister under his predecessor, François Hollande, Macron apparently held secret meetings which resulted in secret deals that undermined laws created to regulate Uber, satisfy taxi drivers, protect passengers, and honor the national labor code. French leftist parliamentarians have openly accused Macron of favoring the interests of an American company over those of his own government. Macron faced similar accusations in 2015 when he guided the sale of French energy giant Alstom to America's General Electric. A defiant Macron shockingly said he would, quote, do it again tomorrow, even though Uber's promises of good jobs and economic prosperity have resoundingly failed in France and elsewhere and caused many indebted taxi drivers to commit suicide.
Taxi drivers are not surprised. We saw that Uber is not good at creating jobs, but for creating a new type of slavery. We love our jobs and our cities, and passengers understood that, and Uber has lost here. Uber dangerously does not respect the laws over and over again, while Macron needs this type of behind-the-scenes lobbies to inflict his type of politics.
Macron has often been accused of attempting the Uberization of all of French society. The accuracy of that criticism appears more just than ever.
Uber has reaped the consequence of their nonsense in France because the government refused to control them with our laws. Uber is more expensive than taxis now and not popular. The Uber market can compete with the taxi market, but there has to be regulation.
The scandal is a reminder that while Western liberal economics claims to be based on fair, free market competition, political corruption is routinely employed to create monopolies, inequalities, and to subvert democratic laws. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
And that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour, but don't go away.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The brazenness of Israeli actions is pretty striking. They do what they want, knowing the United States will support them, says Noam Chomsky, linguist and intellectual, in an interview with Mint Press News. This article is written by Ramzi Barut, journalist, published under the heading Chomsky on Israeli Regime Apartheid and BDS. Stay tuned for the details, please. Even before the crisis in Eastern Europe, the world was clearly experiencing an interregnum of sorts. The Iraqi war, the Afghanistan war, the global recession, the refugee crisis, the new scramble for Africa, the U.S. attempt at weakening China, the U.S. own political inability and instability, the war on democracy, and the decline of the American empire. Recent events, however, have finally given these earth-shattering changes greater clarity, with Russia making its move against NATO expansion, and with China and other rising economies, including BRICS nations, refusing to toe the American line. To reflect on all these changes and more, Min Press News has spoken with the world's most cited intellectual, Professor Noam Chomsky. Dinner View, however, largely focused on Palestine. Chomsky's views of the language, the tactics, and solutions affiliated with the Palestinian struggle and the Palestinian discourse. Chomsky believes that calling Israeli regime policies towards Palestinians apartheid is actually a gift to Israel, at least if by apartheid one refers to the South African-style apartheid. I have held for a long time that the occupied territories are much worse than South Africa. South Africa needed its black population. It relied on them, Chomsky said, adding, "The black population was 85% of the population. It was the workforce. The country couldn't function without that population, and as a result, they tried to make their situation more or less tolerable to the international community. They were hoping for international recognition, which they didn't get." So, if the Bantustans were, in Chomsky's opinion, more or less livable, the same is not true for the Palestinians in the occupied territories. The Zionist regime just wants to get rid of the people, doesn't want them. And its policies for the last 50 years, with not much variation, have been just somehow making life unlivable. So you will go to somewhere else. Chomsky said these repressive policies apply in the entirety of the Palestinian territory. In Gaza, they just destroy them. There is over 2 million people now living in hygienic conditions, barely survivable. International law organizations say that they're not likely to even be able to survive in a couple of years. In the occupied territories in the West Bank, atrocities take place every day. Chomsky also thinks that the Zionist regime, unlike South Africa, is not seeking the international community's approval. The brazenness of Israeli regime actions is pretty striking. They do what they want, knowing the United States will support them. Well, this is much worse than what happened in South Africa. It's not an effort to somehow accommodate the Palestinian population as a suppressed workforce. It's just to get rid of them. The events of May 2021 and the popular unity among Palestinians are a very positive change in Chomsky's opinion. So I think this is a positive step. It is wise and promising for Palestinians to recognize we're all in it together, and that includes the diaspora communities. Yes, it's a common struggle, Chomsky concluded. The United States is going in the opposite direction, Chomsky continued, as young people are more critical of Israel, more and more supportive of Palestinian rights. Regarding the Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions Movement, BDS, Chomsky acknowledged the significant role played by the global grassroots movement, though he noted that BDS has a mixed record. The movement should become more flexible and more thoughtful about the effects of actions, Chomsky noted. The groundwork is there, Chomsky concluded. It is necessary to think carefully about how to carry it forward.
Food for thought.
Hello, everyone, and let us ponder on what the Holy Prophet's 10th infallible successor, Imam Ali al-Naghi al-Hadi, peace be upon him, has taught us of the merits of performing the ziyara or visitation to the shrine of the immortal martyr of Karbala. There are definite places in which God likes the servants to supplicate to him. One of these places is the tomb of Hussein, the master of the martyrs, peace be upon him.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, defending from being defamed. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of defending from being defamed. In the Islamic lifestyle, when we look at the Islamic text, we see that Islam gives importance to the respect and honor of the people, and it stops us from defaming others. It stops us from defaming our brothers in Iman, our brothers in Islam. Therefore, it is necessary to respect and defend the honor and respect and preserve the respect of the others in the Islamic text. When we look at the Islamic text, it says that it is forbidden to defame someone. Therefore, it is necessary to defend others from being defamed. And this defamation defense is an important part in the Islamic lifestyle, where we are dealing with the people, where we are socializing with others, and we are the social animals. When we are living in a society, in that society, we must respect each other. And if there is anything that is coming, and if there is a cause of defame of any one of us, we must defend it. We must come as a defender, and we must defend the fame of a person, the respect of the person, so that the others do not defame him, so the others do not disrespect him. And when he is a brother in Iman, when he is a brother, when he is someone who's living in our society where Allah has said to hide the faults of this person, therefore, on the other hand, it is necessary to defend and to defend him from being defamed in the society, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of defending from being defamed. And in the Islamic text, we see that it is necessary to defend our mu'min brother, a Muslim brother, from being defamed in a place, in a society. Why? Because Allah has said to keep his respect, his honor, to preserve his respect and honor. There is a saying from the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. He said that man radda an ardi irdi akhihi kana lahu hijaban min an-nar. Whoever stops or defends his brother in iman, the brother mu'min brother, from being defamed in front of others, Allah will save him from the hellfire. Allah will save this person. Why? Because when Allah, who knows everything, who knows his faults, what he used to perform when he was alone, and when what he performs in front of people, when Allah has saved him, when Allah did not made things apparent, or he did not disclose his amal or deeds in front of people, how can a person does that? How can a person dare to perform such an action in which a mu'min is being defamed? Therefore, it is necessary to avoid such things. It is necessary to avoid such sittings in which we sit and we talk about others. We humiliate others. We joke. We make jokes about others. Maybe we know about something and we are trying to be someone who is too smart. So Allah says, do not be that smart. Allah knows everything. Allah knows about yourself as well. If someone is cause of defaming of others, then Allah made him. He puts him in the same situation. If someone does not keep the secrets of the others, Allah does not keep the secrets of this person. Therefore, we must avoid such things, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
News, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With the light.
Children in Qatar are helping a conservation program revive the population of a critically endangered species of turtles. The children help release the baby turtles after they hatch, which usually takes place during the dark hours of the evening. The hawksbill mothers are cared for, if needed, when they arrive at the beach today. Their eggs. When the little turtles emerge, the weaker ones are taken to facilities at the foundation. There they are cared for until they are strong enough to be returned to sea. Program managers say getting children involved helps raise awareness about the endangered species and how they can help prevent some of the challenges these turtles face.
As adults, we are kind of beyond hope. Our brain is no longer plastic. We can't really learn new things. But children have the power to really internalize all these things that they're learning, that they're seeing. They make these habits part of their life. They make decisions based on, is it good for the environment, alongside with economic value for money kind of decisions. And this is what we want to cultivate.
The children also get a chance to form bonds with the Hawksbill turtles. Some of them have even named the one they are going to release. That's why life experts with the conservation program say only 1% of every 1,000 hatchlings make it to adulthood. Poaching, climate change, fishing nets and marine pollution have all contributed to the dwindling numbers of the species. The program was launched roughly a decade ago and has released 30,000 hatchlings into the sea in the last 5 years. Experts are optimistic about the success of the program. Elephants are the largest living animals on Earth that, in many cultures, are associated with good luck, wisdom and fertility. But their overpopulation has become a matter of concern in the southeastern African nation of Malawi.
We want to reduce the population of elephants in this park, in Liwonde National Park, because currently we have 600 plus elephants in this park. We would be comfortable, ecologically speaking, that is, to have 300 elephants in this park.
Officials say they will relocate 250 elephants from a national park in a southern town to another park by the end of July. They say the plan is part of a national conservation initiative to maintain healthy habitats in the country's national parks. Establishing viable elephant populations and ensuring the prosperity of local communities around the parks are said to be the other aspects. Residents say the elephants often stray into their gardens and damage their crops. Authorities had relocated some 300 elephants from the same town in 2019.
A zoo in Mexico City celebrates the birthday of two very special residents, bringing cheers and excitement to visitors. Chinese pandas Xin Xin and Xuan Xuan have turned 35 and 33, becoming the oldest pandas in human captivity. China gifted their ancestors to Mexico back in 1975 to boost the relationship between the two countries. Later on, and thanks to the hard work of caretaker teams, 8 cubs were born from the parents. Zoo officials say for them, learning the A to Z of panda care was a long journey.
The pandas living in Chapultepec, Xuan Xuan and Xin Xin, turned 35 and 33 years old, respectively. When their parents arrived, we didn't know much about pandas, so vets and biologists had to follow recommendations from those who took care of giant pandas in the People's Republic of China. From then on, we evolved. We found new and better diets and daily care practices such as vaccine administration or parasite removal. Then they started to breed, which was quite a success since it was the first panda that was born and which survived named Toy.
The birthday celebration has coincided with the zoo's 99th foundation anniversary. A panda's normal lifespan is estimated at about 15 to 20 years for those out in nature and about 30 years for the ones in human care. But the good news is, despite their old age, Xuan Xuan and Xin Xin are in perfectly good shape. A goat in the Pakistani city of Karachi has made the headlines for its not-so-ordinary looks. The animal owns strikingly long ears. Simba was only born last month and his ears have already reached the length of 54 centimeters. The goat's breeder, Muhammad Hassan Narejo, says he has approached Guinness World Records to see if Simba can be included as the greatest of all time, or the goat, for this peculiar feature. The kid is in the center of attention, so he receives all sorts of help to live a smoother life. This includes a special harness for his ears and daily religious rituals to wish him good health. The breeder says that by promoting Simba's image, he is trying to introduce Pakistan as a major goat breeding nation.
The sky is the limit for wind sports in Iraq's Kurdistan region as members of the paragliding team launched into the sunset. Tourists have also come to watch team members bravely run towards the edge of the cliff of Mount Asmar. They usually take off facing the west to catch the sunset and then glide down towards the grey green meadows. The windy landscape around Iraq's northeastern city of Sulaymaniyah is a hot spot for paragliding. Participants of the sport say it requires a lot of physical strength and mental concentration. Some say their favorite aspect of the activity is the intense silence when flying high above the ground. There are many big restaurants with Michelin stars awarded based on their quality. But you will be amazed to know that an eatery located in a tiny village in Greenland also has this badge of honor, making it the world's most remote Michelin-starred restaurant. This eatery in the village, which is home to only 53 people, serves you what it gets from its immediate surroundings. Looking out over the chilly North Atlantic, customers taste a variety of local products, ranging from whale skin to an Arctic bird whose entire wing, including feathers, is on the plate. The restaurant is so remote that you can only reach there by boat through floating icebergs. The head chef says he forages for wild berries, flowers, and herbs every day since the menu largely includes local flavors.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
A young British artist has found an incredible way to create art using not pen or paper, but typewriter. Symbols and letters are turned into complex drawings by this 25-year-old's adept fingers, gaining him attention online. London-based James Cork, who studied architecture, used to draw portraits. But that all changed when he discovered his now signature tool, the typewriter, in 2014. He says the idea came to his mind when he came across Paul Smith, an artist from the 1920s, who produced similar work. Initially, Cook thought it impossible, but he gave it a try. Now, after 8 years, he can draw complex images from Hollywood star Tom Hanks to the London Eye or the Millennium Bell. But while his works appear flawless to viewers, Cook says it never gets any easier and that it's always a challenge for him.
There's something really satisfying about kind of using this sort of limited palette of... You basically have about 44 keys on a typewriter on average. So you've got a kind of puzzle piece, those letters, numbers, punctuation marks together to make a drawing.
Recently, online interest has encouraged Cook to pursue his passion. People donate their typewriters to Cook, who gives these machines a second life. He now has a collection of more than 40 typewriters dating from the early 20s.
Colombia's long hunt for a fabled Spanish ship, San Jose Galleon, that sank centuries ago, comes to an end. But the mission leads to two more nearby shipwrecks filled with treasures.
We have found two additional ships, one ship that is from the colonial period and another that, from the point of view of preliminary analysis, corresponds to the Republican period of our history. We also have related vessels, around a dozen similar boats, that will be located by our Navy.
The colonial-era vessels were found near Colombia's Caribbean port of Cartagena. A remotely operated vehicle reached 900 meters beneath to capture the shipwrecks and treasures inside them. San Jose galleon sank in a deadly battle against English warships in 1708, taking with it billions in treasure. The Colombian president says the findings will be preserved and protected until extraction is done completely. The riches will then be displayed in museums.
Colombian scientists managed to reproduce an endangered species of frog, bringing it back from the brink of extinction. The scientists were able to reproduce 29 specimens of Lehman's poison frog after years of investigations and experiments using a lab built specifically for this species. They have released the frogs into the Colombian Pacific region with the hope of starting its repopulation.
We observe how the frogs adapt to this ecosystem, which is theirs, but it is a constant monitoring. And the idea is that of these first 29 frogs at the moment, there will be many more little frogs, and now we can tell the world that they are not in danger of extinction.
The scientists, however, warned that this particular species of frog is very difficult to reproduce or maintain under human care. They are also worried about the illegal trade of the frogs, which has already played a key role in pushing the rare species towards extinction. Colombia is home to over 700 frog species, more than any other country in the world except Brazil. In Brazil, a 100-year-old man has broken the world record for the longest spell working at a single company. Walter Orthman has entered the Guinness World Record books for working at the same fabric company for an astonishing period of 84 years. He started on the factory floor before moving into administration and later on into the sales management. Despite his extraordinary accomplishment, Orthman's advice for those looking for a long and fulfilling professional life is surprisingly routine.
You have to like to work. I started to work with that willingness and fighting spirit. You also have to start working on something you like to do. You can't just do any job to say that you're working. That doesn't work. You're not going to be able to stand it. You have to look for a job that you like to do. And there, you won't even feel the time passing. That's what happened with me. I started working here, and I liked it. I worked my way up from point to point until I got to the position I'm in today.
Orthman says his secret to a long life and breaking the record is having a healthy lifestyle and staying away from junk food. He says he avoids sugar and salt as much as possible and tries to keep a diet that is healthy for the mind and soul. In order to stay sharp, Orthman says he does stretches and maintains physical activity.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight.
According to a United Nations report, a market-based focus on short-term profits and economic growth means the wider benefits of nature have been ignored, which has led to bad decisions that have reduced people's well-being and contributed to climate change and nature crises. We now present you an article written by Phoebe Weston. The piece is titled, UN Report Finds Humans Need to Value Nature as Well as Profits to Survive. Four-year assessment by 82 leading scientists has found, taking into account all the benefits nature provides to humans and redefining what it means to have a good quality of life, is key to living sustainably on Earth. According to a United Nations report, a market-based focus on short-term profits and economic growth means the wider benefits of nature have been ignored, which has led to bad decisions that have reduced people's well-being and contributed to climate change and to nature crisis. To achieve sustainable development, qualitative approaches need to be incorporated into decision-making. According to the report by the Intergovernmental Science Policy Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services, or IPBES, this means properly valuing the spiritual, cultural, and emotional values that nature brings to humans. The assessment includes more than 13,000 references, including scientific papers and indigenous and local sources of information. It was done in collaboration with experts in social sciences, economics, and humanities. The report builds on the Dasgupta Review, which found the planet is being put at extreme risk by the failure of economists to take account of the true value of nature. The report says incorporating diverse worldviews and knowledge systems will be key to leading to a more sustainable future. Professor Unai Pascual from the Basque Center for Climate Change, who co-chaired the assessment on the diverse values and valuation of nature, said, "There has been a dominant way of taking decisions based on things that look more simple, super quantitative, and more scientific, and we're saying, no, that's not good science. There are a lot of social sciences and humanities and other knowledge systems that can also tell us how to do things." The review highlights four general perspectives that should be taken into account. Living from nature, which refers to its ability to provide us with our needs like food and material goods. Living with nature, which is the right of non-human life to thrive. Living in nature, which refers to people's right to a sense of place and identity. And finally, living as nature, which treats the world as a spiritual part of being human. Professor Mike Christie of Aberystwyth University's Business School in Wales says the type and quality of information that valuation studies can produce largely depends on how, why, and by whom valuation is designed and applied. He added, "This influences whose and which values of nature would be recognized in decisions, and how fairly the benefits and burdens of these decisions would be distributed. There are 50 different methods of approaches of making the value of nature visible in decisions. Yet, researchers found that the way stakeholders valued nature was only taken into account on 2% of the studies." Authors say, moving forward, there are many tools available to make the values of nature visible, and these need to be implemented. One way of working in using citizen assemblies, which reflect the sociology of a given people and gives them a chance to discuss their values, interests, and understandings. There are happening at a national level in a number of countries. One successful example was the Indian government's decision not to mine near the Niamgiri Mountain, which is sacred for the Dongariya Khond people. The intrinsic value of the site for rare species and its cultural and spiritual value to indigenous people was seen as more valuable than the financial gains from mining at the site. Professor Patricia Balvanera of the National Autonomous University of Mexico, who co-chaired the assessment, says, "There are consequences of not taking other values into account, such as environmental leaders being killed because they had claims to land that have been ignored." Professor Balvanera said, "The evidence shows that if, from the onset, local values are taken into consideration, people will feel part of the project and will be more on board with whatever was agreed. This entails redefining development and good quality of life and recognizing the multiple ways people relate to each other and to the natural world." The assessment was approved by representatives of 139 countries in the city of Bonn, Germany. Professor Unai Pasquale from the Bas Center for Climate Change said, "The delegates who endorsed this report say this is a game changer. They realize we've been going through a way of understanding nature in a too narrow sense, and that has brought us to this situation where we live in a planet with interconnected crises. This report is one ingredient out of many which will be needed to convince very powerful stakeholders and decision makers to start changing the way they treat nature." The Intergovernmental Science Policy Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystems Service, or IPBES, which is the equivalent of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, for biodiversity, was set up to provide governments across the world with scientific advice on how to protect nature. Recently, it released another report that found wild species support half of the world's population, but their future use is threatened by over-exploitation. It comes ahead of the Convention on Biological Diversity, or CBD, COP15 in Montreal in Canada in December, which will set the next decade of nature targets, and authors say the findings should provide a valuable contribution to the process. Elizabeth Maruma Marema, Executive Secretary of the Convention on Biological Diversity, or CBD, says, "I applaud the work of all IPBES experts for this and look forward to its active use by all parties and stakeholders to the convention." The relationship between humans and nature is under intense and increasing strain. The report released recently by the Intergovernmental Science Policy Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystems Services, and akin to the IPCC report on climate change, provides compelling evidence that humans are overexploiting wild species and habitats. Harmful activities, including habitat destruction, poor farming practices and pollution, have altered ecosystems significantly, driving many species past the point of recovery. In Britain alone, of the 8,431 species assessed in the 2019 State of Nature report, 1,188 are threatened with extinction. Globally, there are an estimated 1 million species at risk, with biodiversity declining at a faster rate than at any time in human history. We cannot ignore biodiversity loss. Biodiversity is the variability that exists among all living organisms, between different species, within species, including genetic makeup, and in wider ecosystems. Billions of people rely on wild species for food, clean water, energy, income, and health and well-being. Annually, crops worth up to £480 billion are pollinated by a variety of wild animals,